Wilhelm!
Yeah, I'll just fill my pipe.
Kill them. Kill them both. We're missing Antiques Roadshow.
Aren't you ever dramatizing this situation?
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hi people, yes, I am back. We are back from our vacation, and we had a fucking lovely time, to be really honest with you. It was just the best. Loved Darwin. If anybody in Australia or even overseas hasn't been to Darwin, get your ass up there as soon as you possibly can. It's hot, it's humid, the fruit and vegetables are fresh, the people there are very welcoming and wonderful. The place has got just about the right pace for a city, not too fast, not too slow. It's not a place without problems, but we really enjoyed it, and if we had the money, we would move there. That's how seriously we enjoy this place. We're looking into the possibility of doing it sometime in the future. In fact, it really is a lovely place. And, of course, with the internet being as pervasive as it is, it doesn't matter where you live. As long as you can get some access, you can actually thrive there. And there are jobs up there, too, which is not and then small consideration. But anyway, loved it. I did swim with the crocodiles. I did. One of them attacked me. It was a female about 2.5 meters long, came up underneath the cage and took a chunk out of it. I didn't see it. I was busy looking elsewhere while I was in the water, swimming, you know, looking around. And this female croc laying in the bottom of the pool just came up, went, ung. The 850-kilo, 6-meter one didn't attack me, but I got very close to that in the water. And it's, to be honest with you, it's not actually scary. It's there's a kind of disconnect. You go, okay, I'm in the water in a Perspex tank with an 850-kilogram crocodile. Why am I trying to attract its attention? It's a bucket list kind of experience there. Had a great time. Got to hold a smaller baby crocodile. I got to feed one that was about 350 kilo, with a broom pole and a piece of rope that had a chunk of chicken on the end of it. And I did eat some crocodile too. There's some very nice crocodile sausage. Now, I'll tell you what crocodile tastes like. Crocodile tastes like chicken, but has the texture of pork. It's a little bit weird because of that, but it's not a gamey meat at all, and it is quite nutritious, very lean, and they have a ton of crocodiles up there. The populations are extremely large, so it's not like you're eating something that may be endangered. And, Darwin is a very crocodile-oriented city. I did also do I got interviewed by ABC Local Radio in Darwin. As you know, I do the ABC gig now and then to talk about movies on a Friday night with Ivor Coll. I got to meet Ivor, and he did about a 20-25 minute interview with me just talking about my life in movies and things like that, which he broadcast on his evening show later on. lovely guy. Really did have a good time up there. We did meet him and his wife, Casey, and just enjoyed it. We did the interview at lunchtime and then went across the road to the pub, which is a very Territorian kind of thing to do. So Darwin was fantastic. Went to Broken Hill, saw the Mad Max 2 Museum, which is not very big. It's basically a large shed with some of the cars from the movie at the back and a lot of props and bits and pieces from the movie on the inside. But it was interesting to see that too. Went out to Silverton, the town where they filmed it. They're actually doing pre-production on Fury Road, the new Mad Max movie out there. They've got a bit of a problem at the moment because everything's green. There's been so much rain across Australia due to the La Nina effect that all the desert parts are blooming green. You can still see the dirt, red dirt between the bushes and things, but it's not looking very deserty at the moment. It's more looking kind of like a pampas or something like that. So, yeah, so we did that. We're back again, back at work. Great experience. I really needed the holiday, to be honest with you guys. I really needed the break, and Sal and I had a lovely time. I bought a machete while I was in the Northern Territory too, as some of you may have known from Facebook. I'm not sure why I've never owned a machete before, but geez, they're fun. Great big bush knife. Useful for home invasions in countries that have very tight gun laws, and also kind of cool just to go out in the backyard and swing it around a bit. So I can definitely understand why Danny Trejo is into them. So that's pretty much it. I'm going to do a little bit of a music break now, and then I'm going to go into what I've been watching. And before I do, I'm going to let you know what we're going to do this time. As you know, I've been challenged that I need to do some movies from the 1930s and 1940s because I've been hitting the 60s and 70s pretty heavily lately. So I've kind of went through the great archive. Just imagine the warehouse where the Ark of the Covenant stored with DVDs. That's where I was looking. And tried to find some movies from the 30s and 40s that I could talk about. And I kind of went lateral on it a little bit. So here's what we're doing. From 1931, Dracula and Frankenstein. 1941, The Wolfman. So I'm going Universal Horror Films for this one. Done my research, got everything nailed down, copious notes. So they're the three movies that we're looking at. Problem I've got with doing that, of course, is that everything that can be said about these films has been said to a certain extent. So I'm kind of going more with the impressions I got re-watching them than the going through the history of them too much. I will do some of that, but I really want to kind of go with which ones I like most, what I liked about them, what I didn't like about them, and there are a couple of things in a couple of them that I found a little bit problematic. But anyway, I'm going to do that. But first, I will play some music.
Dal nero mantello, di notte tu succhi nel collo, le donne di giovane età. Dracula, Dracula, dra, coi bianchi affilati canini, tu fai spaventare i bambini, le mamme, le nonne, papà. Spiritoso, qualcuno può arrabbiarsi, darti puro un schiaffone. Il tumorso velenoso potrebbe far venire un'infezione. Dracula, Dracula, dra, sei forte, sei nero, sei bello. Perché non ti succhi un bel pollo e lasci le donne campare? Dracula, Dracula, dra, cia, cia, cia. Vampiro dal nero mantello, di notte tu succhi nel collo.
Don in Campa.
Dracula, Dracula, Dracula.
Dracula, Dracula, Dracula. Sei forte, sei nero, sei bello. Perché non ti succhi un bel pollo e lasci le donne campare? Dracula.
That was a bit of an Afro-Cuban version of Dracula Cha-Cha-Cha, the Bruno Martino song. It was by Tango Saloon and Mike Patton. Not sure I like it better than I like the original, but I just thought I'd vary things up because I have played the other Dracula Cha-Cha-Cha on a podcast before. So, what have I been watching? While I was away, I didn't watch a lot of movies. I was actually living movies more than watching them. I was doing interesting things, feeding crocs, as I said, and swanning around tropical paradise and checking out World War II airstrips that have been preserved due to the fact that, well, Darwin was bombed by the Japanese during World War II. So there's a bit of a history there with it. And in general, not watching a lot. But since I got back, let's see, I watched The Naked Jungle because I'm going to be talking about that with Ivor in ABC Darwin soon. So I thought I'd refresh myself on that. I've talked about it on a podcast before. Charlton Heston, Eleanor Parker, William Conrad, and shitloads of ants. I did watch The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen again. It's one of those ones that I occasionally dip into, hoping that it'll look better upon further viewing, and it doesn't. It's an opportunity wasted. If you read the original graphic novels, which I do recommend for movie buffs, there's a whole meta thing going on with those two. There are little bits and pieces in the panels which hark back to other media, kind of in the same way that Kim Newman's work often does. And so it's definitely worth checking out for that. I did see a documentary, American Scary, about American horror movie hosts. And, yeah, that was a bit of fun. I don't think it was the best put-together documentary I've ever seen, but it covers the waterfront of American horror movie hosts pretty well and does a reasonable job of that. Maybe a better editor and maybe, yeah, just a little bit of a tighter format might have worked in its favour. It's from about 1996, I think, so it's not the most recent one, but yeah, it's pretty good. I did watch The Red Shoes again, Michael Powell. I've got to do a podcast about that soon. I'm not going to talk too much about it and take the gloss off it. Definitely want to see Powell and Pressburger, Moira Shearer, Robert Helpman, Anton Warbrook. Just a classic. I did see a kind of piece of fluff from the 1960s Gambit, starring Michael Caine and Shirley MacLaine, who don't have a lot of chemistry together as a couple in this kind of caper film. But it's got an interesting structure to it. I'm not going to do a spoiler and say what the structure is, but it's not one to avoid, but if you've got a little bit of time and it's available, it might be a bit of a time passer for you. Did see a slightly better but flawed movie directed by Brian Forbes, also starring Michael Caine, called Deadfall from 1968, which has got a kick-ass John Barry score, which is woven into the movie a lot deeper than most scores are, because they've actually got part of the score is a concert being conducted by John Barry of the music, which is integrated into a caper a robbery that Michael Caine's character playing a cat burglar does. It's an interesting one. It's got Nanette Newman, Brian Forbes' wife, in it, which is a bit of a dead loss, and Eric Porter. It's worth checking out anyway. Let's see what I've got there. I did see a very small Brit crime drama from 1957 called The Flesh is Weak, which is it stars John Derrick and a girl called Millie Vital. It's about a guy played by John Derrick who convinces girls who are new to London he kind of basically seduces them into prostitution. It's a nice small crime drama. It's the sort of thing that would play on TV these days if it was going to be done again, but not a bad little film, very dark, black and white. It tackled a topic that wasn't really being tackled in movies at that stage, so it's worth it for that as well. Let's see what else I've been watching. Just checking back on it. Nothing else to really speak of. As I said, I've gone into a fallow period. It's probably a good time for me to get away from movies while I was off and about doing stuff on vacation. So, yeah, and it's refreshed me to come back and, of course, do what I'm doing now. Anyway, on to the films. I'm going to do them in chronological order for the three movies, Dracula, Frankenstein, and The Wolfman. So I'm going with the biggies. One day I'll have to do Creature from the Black Lagoon as well, just to kind of get all the major monsters covered on this. But, yeah, I rewatched Dracula today, directed by Todd Browning ostensibly, though there is a lot of modern film historians who believe that the cinematographer Carl Freund did a lot of the work that Todd Browning was supposed to do for this film. I mean, apart from a movie like Freaks and a couple of the silent things he did, I'm not that big a Todd Browning fan. I don't think he embraced sound when it came out particularly well. And I think the tendency towards static camera work worked against his long-term career as a film director. Yes, he's got the reputation, but as I'll point out a little bit later when I talk about Frankenstein, I think that James Whale basically kicks his ass big time when it comes to making a decent horror film. Now, we all know the backstory of this Bram Stoker's Dracula. Bram Stoker was a theatre manager for William Irving at around the turn of the century. Wrote this book partly based upon the guy he worked for. William Irving was an enormous stage actor and monster in his own way of the time. He was the you know, the really big actor on stage. And basically Stoker was his bitch for a number of years. So he actually offered to do organized stage production with William Irving of Dracula, but Irving declined. So Dracula, the book, became very popular. It's a bit of a weird book too, because it's made up of found materials almost in a way. Journal entries, audio recordings, all these little bits and pieces put together to tell the story of Dracula. Which doesn't lend it very easily to a film format, particularly in the early days of sound when Universal and the guy who owned and ran it, Carl Lamley, decided to go with making an adaptation of Dracula. The book was a bit difficult for them to do. Structure didn't lend itself to the adaptation. So what they did was, there was a stage version as well, which was immensely popular on both sides of the Atlantic. In England, a guy called Raymond Huntley, who you will see in any number of British comedies from the 1940s to the 1960s, actually was a romantic lead on stage. He played Dracula more than pretty much any person ever, which is a bit odd when you see him. He's kind of like a slightly, you know, bloodhound-faced English character actor playing pompous bureaucrats and things like that, but he was a matinee star when he was playing Dracula on stage. He really went to town with it and was extremely well known before that second career as a character actor in comedies and some dramas, to be fair to him. But he really was first known for that. And then, of course, when it came over to America, there was an adaptation done because there were a lot of kind of English jargon used in the stage adaptation of Dracula, which had to be modified out. And when it came on Broadway, they didn't have too much money left to pay for the guy playing Dracula, so they got a Hungarian actor who spoke very little English, a guy called Bela Lugosi, to do the stage role. And he became, in the same way Raymond Huntley did, of course, a matinee idol. He kind of brought a European kind of grace and sexuality and sensuality and charm to the role, even though Lugosi at the time spoke very little English and learned all of his lines phonetically, according to most of the information I've got. That's the problem. This is 80-odd years ago. Some of the information is anecdotal. Some of it contradicts each other. But for the most part, the consensus is that Lugosi's English wasn't all that crash hot at the time, and that he learned things phonetically, which would have been a monumental intellectual task to learn your part for an entire play in a language you didn't speak, and to do it to the extent that you became incredibly popular, particularly with women, in doing so. Tough ask on that. So, of course, when time came for Universal and Lumley to make the film, they chose both Bela Lugosi and Edward Van Sloan from the original stage version. There were some other actors that were brought in by the studio. Dwight Fry, of course, playing Renfield. Really odd life Dwight Fry had. He kind of got stereotyped as lackeys for monsters. Of course, he appeared again in Frankenstein, and he did this sort of thing a couple of times. He was a Christian Scientist, which is one of those really weird beliefs from my atheistic viewpoint. And they don't do too much medical stuff for themselves. He had a heart condition. He hid it from his family and died on a bus at a very early age because he didn't get the assistance that he needed. So, yeah, that strikes one for atheism against Christian Science, I suppose. Bit of a sad thing for the man. He 10, 20 years later, he could have reinvented himself and done a career in early television if he had chosen to do so. So it was directed by Todd Browning, as I said. Carl Lumley Jr. was actually the producer, even though Carl Lumley was the studio head. And the screenplay was by Garrett Fort, adapted from both Bram Stoker's Dracula and the Dracula play by Hamilton Dean, and the American adaptation by John L. Balderston. So, yeah, the things that interest me about this film are the fact that all the really cool bits of direction weren't done by Todd Browning. They were done by, as I said, Carl Freund, who's a more interesting person from my point of view than Todd Browning himself. Freund started out, he was a cinematographer on a couple of things that may be of interest to people who like paleo cinema. Let me just bring him up on the old IMDb. Did a ton of stuff. Let's have a look here. I'll just go through a few of the things he did before he did Dracula. Of course, he started out in Europe, as many of the people we talk about in paleo cinema did. He was the cinematographer on The Last Laugh with Conrad Veidt, a little film called Metropolis. He was also the cinematographer on The Golem, the 1920 movie of that, starring Paul Wegener. So basically, before he came and ended up doing the cinematographer gig on Dracula, he had a 20-year career in cinema as a cinematographer and really knew his chops. And one of the legacies that we have from Carl Freund, which I find very interesting, he went on to do a whole bunch of other movies as a cinematographer. He won an Academy Award for his cinematography in The Good Earth in 1937. He did Camille, The Great Ziegfeld, Golden Boy, which is, I think, one of the very first films with William Holden, but let me just double check that. He was a cinematographer on Balalaika as well. A Yank at Eton, Du Barry Was a Lady, Cry Havoc, A Guy Named Joe, The Thin Man Goes Home. And then he went into television. He became a kind of the cinematographer on television. He's the guy who invented that kind of flat lighting they have in sitcoms. You know how the sets are really well lit evenly, so there are no shadows, so you can have the three-camera format to film a sitcom in front of a live audience. Carl Freund is the guy who invented that lighting so that there wouldn't be the shadows. You could film from three different directions at once. You save money. You could get a studio audience in. You didn't have to change the lighting for every scene. He's the guy who invented that and still being used. Now, if you have a look at a sitcom like The Big Bang Theory, Carl Freund type lighting is still being used in that show right up to this very day. So he's got, in his own way, more of a heritage in cinema and in cinematography than the films like Dracula and people like Todd Browning. He had much a longer lingering influence on a very basic part of the industry these days. So I found that part of things very interesting. So I rewatched the film today. And the thing I found interesting is that it's in that transitional phase between sound and silent. It's in that 5-year period when they were kind of working out how to do things very much. It's only a few years. This film was only made a few years after Al Jolson said this.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
In The Jazz Singer. And this is kind of the first supernatural thriller made in sound by a big studio. So it's got a very stagey look to it. And a lot of the acting is kind of somewhere between stage acting and silent film acting to a large extent. Even Lugosi himself in it is kind of very stagey. He's done the role a number of times on the stage, so he's got his moves down. He's got his glaring eye gestures down. He's got that sort of thing going for him. But really, it does. I mean, it's 80 years old, this film. It's as old as William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, to be fair. But really, it does kind of suffer in retrospect. Yes, you can see that this is the start of a long career for vampires in cinema. And, of course, Nosferatu started that way before in the silent era, being a kind of illegal adaptation of Stoker's Dracula itself. But it's kind of like an ancestor that's a bit kind of demented in a sense. It's really like, you know, the great-great-grandfather who sits at the family barbecues and spouts racist things and forgets who people are. It's kind of got that, it's in its dotage kind of thing, but because of its relationship with everything that came afterwards, it's well respected. And I found, of the three films, I found it the least accessible and the least enjoyable for that reason. I think that it's clumsy. I mean, the fact that they used possums for rats in the film and all sorts of weird little bits and pieces like that, and armadillos crawling across the Dracula's castle, that's got a certain weirdness that I like about it, but it's still, I find it a little bit difficult. And of the three films, I've really found it the least impressive in a lot of ways. Now, I'm going to play a bit of audio from it anyway, and I'm sorry if I disappoint people by saying that, but I think Lugosi was very stagey in what he did, and I don't think Todd Browning is the best director, even of that time, for this sort of material.
I am Dracula. A moment ago, I stumbled upon a most amazing phenomenon. Something so incredible, I mistrust my own judgment. Look.
Dracula. The very mention of the name brings to mind things so evil, so fantastic, so degrading. You wonder if it isn't all a dream, a nightmare.
Rats, thousands, millions of them.
But no, this is no dream. This is Dracula, the original terrifying story of a maniac and a man who lived after death, lived on human blood, took the form of a vampire bat, and lured innocent girls to a fate truly worse than death.
Dracula? What's he done to you, dearie? Tell me.
He came to me. He opened a thing in his arm. And he made me drink.
Now, while I say I didn't enjoy this film as much as I did the other two, I really don't want to take away from its historic importance either. It is kind of seminal. It did have a profound effect on people at the time it came out too, so we can't kind of dismiss it in that way. But looking back on it and looking back on it with the wisdom of another 80 years of cinema technology and artistry, of course, as well, it's the one that kind of is least far along that curve of learning. And of course, there were some problems as well. The stock market crash had hit a couple of years before, and the budget was severely cut, so that's why they adapted the stage play rather than trying to do a full-fleshed adaptation of Bram Stoker's original novel. So it did suffer from those kind of constraints. But what I do find interesting, and I did watch both of these. I watched the Spanish language version as well, which is on the disc you get when you get Dracula on DVD. They filmed it at night on the same sets that they film the English language version of Dracula on during the daytime. Totally different cast, same costumes, same sets, same everything. But it's a much more interesting film. It really is, because it's got a lot more motion and passion, and they kind of rethought what the English language guys during the daytime did, and really going with it. I don't think the guy playing Dracula in that version is as good as Bela Lugosi, but I think that as a film taken as a whole, I think it's a much more interesting one. And that may be heresy to a number of people. I don't particularly care, because I've been heretical since I was 20. So really, I'm past worrying about that sort of thing. But I think it's worth watching them both. If you're going to watch them back to back. Yeah, spend a little time. Get out two packets of Pringles instead of one. And just go for it. And but I think it's important to kind of go back on these films and just see. And also, one of the things about being a movie buff and knowing a little bit about movies is you can learn as much from a failure as from a success. You can go, okay, that didn't work for that reason, and what maybe they should have done here is this, and maybe they should have moved the camera there, and maybe they needed to do a close-up here. And I did a little bit of that while I was watching this film. And for that reason, it was more interesting than just going, oh, this is fucking boring, but kind of being an active participant in the film. And really going into it and saying, okay, here's what I reckon they should have done. And I know it's easy to do that, and I know it can be considered dismissive to do that, but I found it interesting to do that while I was watching the film, and when I wasn't chasing kittens around and things like that. But yeah, Dracula, of the three, the least successful, because it was the first one, and I assume that the studio and the technicians and the producers and things like that learned from that early film how better to do things when it came time to do Dracula, and then of course a decade later to do Frankenstein, and then a decade later to do the Wolfman. They kind of learned it. They also learned that there was an audience for this stuff too, because Dracula was gangbuster successful and made millions. It was really kind of fantastically well done. Part of that attraction was that people had seen the stage play. A number of people had seen the stage play on both sides of the Atlantic as well. Some people knew the novel, and they had the most fantastic film posters for it. All of the posters put out and all the promotional material put out at the time for Dracula was top rate. It really kind of was imaginative, it was evocative, it was eye-catching, it lured punters in. And that's never to be discounted as a way of generating bums on seats. So I'm not going to talk much else about Dracula. I think if you're going to watch it, don't watch it back-to-back with, say, the Christopher Lee 1958, I think it is, Dracula. Because I think the time in between has been... Yeah, it's a bit like comparing a kid's drawing with a drawing by a teenager. They've got more skill, even if they're not particularly gifted, they've got more skill at what they do. But because it's the first, of course, and that's the other thing I should mention too. You know all those iconic lines you know from the movie? The children of the night thing and I don't drink wine. Those kind of lines, they're all in the first 15 minutes of the film. So I think they kind of front-loaded the film a little bit with all the really cool stuff. And when it comes to staking Dracula at the end, it's almost kind of an anti-climax, which is a fault of structure. It wasn't a fault of budget particularly, but I think it's a fault of structure. Of course, they would have had a lot of censorship problems with Will Hayes and Joe Breen and people like that at the time, so they would have had their hands tied to a certain extent by those kind of influences. But anyway, that's about it for Dracula. Most people have got a copy of it, and if they haven't, they've got access to a copy of it. It's worth revisiting with that awareness that it was the first supernatural thriller kind of thing being done in the sound era. It was done under a number of constraints, and the lead actor hardly knew the language in which he was acting. So I'm going to take another break now, and then I'm going to get on to what I find a much more interesting project, which, of course, is 1931's Frankenstein, starring Boris Karloff, Colin Clive, and directed by James Whale.
Brazil, where hearts were entertaining June. We stood beneath an amber moon and softly murmured someday soon we kissed and clung together. Then tomorrow was another day. The morning found me miles away, with still a million things to say. Now, when twilight dims the sky above, recalling thrills of our love, there's one thing I'm certain of: return I will to old Brazil. Another day, the morning found me miles away, with still a million things to say. Now, when twilight dims the sky above, recalling thrills of our love, there's one thing that I'm certain of: return I will to old Brazil, that old Brazil. Man, it's old in Brazil.
That, of course, was Frank Sinatra singing in Brazil from his album Songs for Swingin' Lovers. Just thought I'd play that because I just finished reading. The reading I did while I was away on holiday was Lee Server's biography of Ava Gardner called Love Is Nothing, which featured, of course, Frank Sinatra quite frequently due to the fact that he was married to Ava Gardner for a while. So I just thought I'd throw that one in. I'll recommend the book too. It's a very good biography, unfortunately. Every time I read things about Hollywood celebrities of the past, lately, they're all totally fucked up by alcohol. And that's the case with Ava Gardner too. It really did deteriorate the quality of her life for a very long time. Anyway, on to Frankenstein.
How do you do? Mr. Carl Limley feels it would be a little unkind to present this picture without just a word of friendly warning. We are about to unfold the story of Frankenstein, a man of science who sought to create a man after his own image without reckoning upon God. It is one of the strangest tales ever told. It deals with the two great mysteries of creation, life and death. I think it will thrill you. It may shock you. It might even horrify you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to, well, we've warned you.
1931. This one came out 10 months after Dracula, and Dracula had been an enormous success. So Frankenstein, in a sense, benefited from that. It, the Universal realized that you can make a lot of money from a really good, well-made, creepy horror film. And so they went across with this. The person they chose to direct it was an Englishman called James Whale, who you might remember from the movie, 1999 movie Gods and Monsters, was played by Ian McKellen. Basically, yeah, James Whale, World War One veteran, like a lot of other people at the time was. He was a prisoner for a time of the Germans, and he saw any number of very nasty aspects to World War One while he was in the services. He was also a gay gentleman. He was never in the closet. He was always an out gay man, and it never seemed to have much effect on his career, fortunately. So he was enlisted in British Army World War One, and was an officer who was captured by the Germans during the time of prisoner of war. He realised he was interested in drama. This is from Wikipedia. So the main movies he's remembered for, there are actually about five of them. Frankenstein, of course, in 1931. The Old Dark House in 1932, which has a wicked sense of humour. Vince and the peeps over at B-Movie Cast recently covered The Old Dark House. The Invisible Man in 1933, and Bride of Frankenstein in 1935, which, of course, we all know is a camp classic. The other film that he's really well known for is a really quality version of Showboat from 1936, which has kind of faded in memory because the 1950s one that MGM did in Technicolor kind of put the other one in the shade a little bit. But Jimmy Whale, he started out as an artist. So he was an actor, a set designer, and a builder, a stage director when he left the services at the end of World War One, and wandered around doing a lot of regional theatre in England before he got very famous in 1928 from a very high quality stage production of a play called Journey's End about soldiers in the trenches during World War One. The people were starting to address it, and there was a way of dealing with the incredible traumas and hideousness of the war. And it was incredibly popular. It became an enormous success. So that brought him to the attention of film producers, and he went to Hollywood in 1929, signed a contract with Paramount Pictures, and he basically went on from there, and in 1931, Carl Limley Jr. offered him a choice of any property the studio owned if he'd come and make a movie for Universal. And Whale chose Frankenstein mostly because none of the other Universal properties interested him, and he wanted to make something other than a war picture because he became known as a guy who knew about the war, and he wanted to step away from that. So the cast on the film is particularly good. Colin Clive as Henry Frankenstein is really good. Colin Clive went to an early death. He had a number of health problems and didn't live for a very long time. And Mae Clark is pretty good too. Not perfect, but then who was in those days, as his fiancée Elizabeth. And he chose an English actor to play the monster, a guy who had been around playing heavies and all sorts of other things in Hollywood for about a decade, a guy called William Henry Pratt, whose stage name was Boris Karloff. Now, Karloff has an interesting background, and he had a fantastic face as well. He was actually, one of his grandparents was Indian, so he was a mixed blood, which caused him a few hassles in England. He came over to America after immigrating to Canada for a little while, and went on to make a name for himself as a character actor in film. Now, Karloff had that great bone structure, the cheekbones, the kind of bony face. He was very good at the thing. In person, in real life, as everybody knows, he was an incredible gentle man, very intelligent, well-read. He played Santa Claus for years and years for a Hollywood hospital. Every year, Santa Claus would turn up for two decades, and give out presents to the children who were in hospital. And nobody knew, apart from the grown-ups, that the guy doing it was actually the guy who created Frankenstein's monster. So, we've got a lot of time for Boris Karloff. He was a gentleman and very well respected. And I rewatched this film not an hour ago. I took a little break to watch Frankenstein again in between recording the Dracula bit and this bit here. And here's my impressions of the movie. Basically, it flows and is paced a lot better than Dracula was. It really does move along at a good rate. Henry Frankenstein leaves medical school. He wants to do his own experiments. He wants to do experiments on human bodies, and that's a little bit frowned on because he's not particularly fussy about where he gets them from. There's a scene at the start with him and Fritz, his hunchback sidekick, played by Dwight Frye, doing things like cutting down hung corpses from the gibbets to use them in the experiments, and he goes off in a very castle and gothic looking tower that he happens to have acquired somewhere and pieces together a human being. Of course, there's that conceit about the fact that the brain stolen by Fritz is an abnormal brain. It's a criminal brain, of course. We now know that that's utter bullshit. There's no such thing as a criminal brain. Most of it's either mental illness or circumstance, so nothing there. But and he creates a monster. Now, Frankenstein's monster, I hadn't seen Frankenstein for a number of years, but Karloff blew me away afresh, really. Here's the things I noticed. We've seen a lot of actors subsequent to Boris Karloff play Frankenstein's monster, and they've always played him as a big, chunky-looking fucker with muscles and a barrel chest and a thick neck with bolts in it. They're not bolts, they're actually electrodes, but everyone thinks that they're bolts. Karloff's Frankenstein is gaunt and lean. He really is kind of almost a scarecrow-y figure in some ways. And of course, then you've got to give all credit to Jack Pierce's fantastic makeup, which he took a very long time to put together. They really thought through the concept of Frankenstein's monster and gave it that flat top look with the scars and the bolts in the neck and the scar tissue around the wrists and the costuming where the sleeves of the jacket are short to make his arms look extended and those enormous heavy boots that Karloff had to wear to lumber around in and, of course, to give him extra height. And one thing I did notice is the top of Frankenstein monster's head isn't flat. It slopes towards the back slightly when Karloff has his head upright. So it's not the way it's portrayed in a lot of things. It's actually kind of back-tilted a little bit, which is really interesting. The close-ups don't really favour the makeup in some ways. I noticed that as well. And, of course, that's a limitation of the fact that this is, in a sense, almost first-generation film makeup. And what they used, they did use rubber, but they used a number of other things as well. And the technologies weren't yet there to seamlessly blend it into human flesh very well. So there are a couple of moments where the makeup lets down, but those moments are more than compensated for by Boris Karloff. And just the way he moves, the way he holds his hands, the way he's got his hands out at one stage, and one hand's tilted out further than the other as if to give the impression that there's something wrong with the ligaments there, that there's something not quite right. The little scene, the famous scene where he's playing with the flowers with the little girl. Have a look at the way Karloff holds his hands in that scene. The fingers aren't held the way we hold fingers. They overlap and they're curled and in a slightly odd manner. And there's lots of little bits like that through the film where Karloff's physical acting really does give that impression of somebody who's a patchwork of other pieces. And that for me is the heart of the film. There's also, you know, Colin Clive as basically the demented Frankenstein who wants to marry his fiancée Elizabeth, whose father is a nice little comic character off to one side and kind of leavens the film with that tiny touch of humour that it needs to stop taking itself entirely seriously, which I really did appreciate. I kind of, Baron Frankenstein, the father, who was played by, let me just find out, it was played by an actor called Frederick Kerr or Frederick Carr. And, yeah, it's one of the saving graces of the film. With these kind of films where you're doing a serious horror film, not having, I mean, I've seen a lot of horror films overdo the humor, but having those tiny little touches of humor in the film gives it an extra dimension that it might not otherwise have. I hate films that are pompous and take themselves too seriously. And I think that in some ways, Dracula suffers from that, that there's not that touch of humor that would be a kind of saving grace of the film and would kind of remind us, even at a subconscious level, that this is supposed to be an entertainment. But Frankenstein does have that. And of course, Bride of Frankenstein is full of it. It's beautifully nuanced between the humor and the serious stuff. But that's for another podcast, maybe, if I get a good response to this one. But the heart of the film is Colin Clive is very good as Frankenstein, and he does have his histrionic moments and over the top and things like that, but he covers it well, the necessities of the role really well. The other thing I really noticed about the film is the beautiful set design on it. Frankenstein's tower, where it's almost like, I don't know if it's a castle or a tower, but it's some kind of a structure made of stone. It's got that beautiful German impressionistic type look to it. It's very tall and lean. All of the sets, they're very high ceilinged and lean, and the eye, by of course Frankenstein's equipment, the Tesla coils and the Van de Graaff generators and things like that, they all kind of lead up towards the sky where the lightning strikes from. But they've got that tall lean look, which kind of echoes and mirrors and reflects the tall leanness of Frankenstein's monster. He seems to sit in that set very well. He's not out of place at all. It's like he's another piece of the landscape or the set itself. So that works really well as well. And there's a kind of iconography to this film as well, the iconography of the electricity and the power of nature. And then, of course, the continued use, Fritz torches Frankenstein's monster with torches. And when the peasants come to get him, there's a sea of torches in the night, just flowing, a river of torches in the night, just flowing towards where the monster is hiding. And, of course, fire being the main thing that the monster is afraid of because of having been tormented by Fritz by the use of a flaming torch is, of course, ultimately what ostensibly destroys the monster when he's trapped in an old mill on a hill, with a lovely look too. I mean, that mill with the great big cross of sails on the front of it, and gives you that slight impression that Frankenstein's monster is an innocent who, due to the fact of his upbringing almost, between the torture by Fritz and the neglect by Frankenstein himself, has become inadvertently a criminal. He kills, I'm not going to do any, this isn't a spoiler on an 80-year-old movie, but he kills Fritz because of that torment. And everything bad that the monster does is either as a result of that abuse or as a result of misunderstanding the situation and misunderstanding things. He's kind of, you know, wandering around without guidance in a sense, where he's in a sense a new being and childlike in a lot of ways. The way he reaches up to the light when Frankenstein opens the skylight in the tower and things like that. But the heart of it is that incredible physical acting that Boris Karloff does in this film. And of course that James Whale encouraged in him. There was a breakout role. Of course, in a sense, Karloff was stereotyped for the rest of his career as the monster, but without it, he wouldn't have been more than a character actor. He brought to the game an incredible level of skill and experience, and also because of his mixed race in England during his upbringing. He was unfairly treated at the time. He's got that knowledge of being an outsider, as indeed does James Whale, being a homosexual man in early 20th century Western civilization. So between them, they've really got that nailed down. Now, one of the things that I found interesting about James Whale, which I should have remembered from seeing Gods and Monsters, is he died in exactly the same way that William Holden died in Sunset Boulevard. He drowned himself in his backyard swimming pool because he'd had a stroke. He was very much, this is in late 1959, I think. He had a stroke. He was in a lot of pain. He was disabled by the stroke in a lot of ways. And the painkillers were dulling his mind. He was a very intellectual man and a very mentally active man. And it became too much for him. And ultimately, he chose to drown himself in his own swimming pool. So a bit of a sad end for a very good director, a very intelligent director, and somebody who could go from making Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein to doing Showboat in a span of 4 years, 5 years, sorry, 1936 for Showboat. And unfortunately, his career didn't go on to bigger and better things after that, but the things he's left us with were quality films. And he was a part of Universal, giving us that incredibly iconic character of Frankenstein's monster. So basically, I've got a greater fondness for Frankenstein as a movie than I do Dracula. I think Dracula is very heavy-handed. And the other differentiation between the two, I said it flowed a lot faster as well, is there are a lot more tracking shots and a lot more creative and motion in the camera. Some of the tracking shots, of course, don't particularly work because they were pushing the dollies over cobblestones in some bits, but it worked really well to enhance the drama at various stages. There's a scene where the dead little girl is being carried into town by her father that really is served well by that tracking shot that occurs when he brings her in. Anyway, I'm not going to go any further than that on Frankenstein. I think it's arguably the best of the three films that I'm reviewing this time around, and I really do appreciate it afresh from having watched it today. So I'm going to take another break, and then we get back with The Wolfman. This is going to be one of the longer podcasts I've done because there's also a lot of feedback, but it's better than having none.
You've been a long while coming.
I'm not buying anything.
And I am not selling anything. I expected you sooner.
Oh, I remember you. That night. And in the crypt.
Go inside. You killed the wolf.
Well, there's no crime in that, is there?
The wolf was Baylor.
You think I don't know the difference between a wolf and a man?
Baylor became a wolf. And you killed him. A werewolf can be killed only with a silver bullet, or a silver knife, or a stick with a silver handle.
You're insane. I tell you, I killed a wolf, a plain, ordinary wolf.
Take this charm, the pentagram, the sign of the wolf. It can break the evil spell.
Evil spell? Pentagram, wolfbane. Oh, I'm sick of the whole thing. I'm going to get out of here.
Whoever is bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself.
Oh, quit handing me that. You're just wasting your time.
The wolf bit you, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he did.
Wear this charm over your heart always.
All right, I'll take it. What's it worth to you? I'll give you...
Do you dare to show me the wound?
What?
Do you dare to show me the wound? Go now. Heaven help you.
Okay, that was Lon Chaney Jr. and Maria Uspenskaya playing Maliva the Gypsy in 1941's The Wolfman. I did enjoy this movie, but not for... I'm kind of off to one centre at the moment watching movies for some reason. I didn't enjoy it because of Lon Chaney Jr. I didn't enjoy it because of the werewolf makeup. I didn't even enjoy it because of Claude Rains, who was the most ridiculous person possible to play the father of Lon Chaney Jr. I enjoyed it because of Maria Uspenskaya playing Maliva the Gypsy. She was an interesting lady, a Russian emigre, of course, who left before the revolution and became a teacher of acting, and went on to do that very, very well for a number of years. But the kind of pacing and the exoticness of this kind of small old lady in gypsy costume, whose son Bela, played by Bela Lugosi, was a werewolf, She really is the heart of the movie in some ways. You can't really say that Lon Chaney Jr. is the heart of the movie. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll do a little bit of a plot synopsis just for those who came in late. Let me just grab my paperwork here, of which I have a lot. And we'll take a look at it. It was written by a guy called Kurt Siodmak, who'd written a whole bunch of stuff. Let me just go into this. It might be a tick. My mouse has disappeared under a pile of paperwork. Okay, we'll give the IMDb synopsis a bit of a go and see how we run with that. Upon the death of his brother, Larry Talbot returns from America to his ancestral home in Wales. He visits a gypsy camp with a village girl, Jenny Williams, who is attacked by Bela, a gypsy who has turned into a werewolf. Larry kills the werewolf but is bitten during the fight. Bela's mother tells him that this will cause him to become a werewolf with each full moon. Larry confesses his plight to his unbelieving father, Sir John, who then joins the villagers in a hunt for the wolf. Larry, transformed by the full moon, heads into the forest at a fateful meeting with both Sir John and Gwen. So that's basically it. We all know the story. We've seen Benicio del Toro do it with Anthony Hopkins and all that sort of thing in the recent one. But, this was Universal. They'd done a whole bunch of other films, and they wanted to create a new property. And they hit up Kurt Siodmak to do that. Kurt Siodmak is another one of the European emigres. And, of course, there are a lot of them in Wolfman 2. There are a lot of European people in this film. Let me just go through a few of them for you. You got Siodmak, of course. You got Claude Rains, another one. Bela Lugosi, Maria Uspenskaya. Even Evelyn Ankers, who plays Gwen, one of the girls that he's interested in. Larry Talbot, played by Lon Chaney Jr., is the one he's interested in. Evelyn Ankers is English as well. And a lot of behind-the-scenes people as well were from Europe, and it gave it a very European feel, which of course is right, because the film, even though it doesn't explicitly state that, is set in Wales. So, Kurt Siodmak, as I said, I'll get back to Kurt Siodmak, the writer of the film. George Wagner, the guy who directed it, kind of middle-of-the-road director, went on to do a lot of TV series right up until the 1960s. The last thing he did was a few episodes of the 1966 Batman TV series. So, Kurt Siodmak lived to be 98, so he was born in 1902 and died in 1998. I'll just give you a bit of an idea about some of the movies he wrote, which is, it's all pretty... Excuse me, pretty impressive there. Let's see, he started in Europe, of course, and he did Black Friday. He wrote the screenplay of Black Friday, The Invisible Man Returns, The Tunnel, which I really like. I did a podcast about The Tunnel a while back. Kurt Siodmak wrote the story for that. Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman later on. The Invisible Agent, which is a bit of fun. I Walk with a Zombie, did the screenplay of that. Son of Dracula, House of Frankenstein, The Beast with Five Fingers. Let's have a look here. Earth versus the Flying Saucers. Okay, let's go on a bit further. And, so basically he was pretty well on top of a whole bunch of really top quality films there. He did direct some movies as well. Let's see what he directed. Magnetic Monster, Bride of the Gorilla. TV short called Tales of Frankenstein, 13 Demon Street, I think, was a TV series that had Lon Chaney Jr. as the host. So, Siodmak was really great. Now, the nice thing about this is he created the werewolf mythology we know out of whole cloth. He really did kind of start all the full moon thing, the wolf bane, the being bitten by a werewolf turns you into a werewolf. That's all Kurt Siodmak. That's not like old legends. That's 1941 expatriate writer living in Hollywood stuff. So everything we think is ancient legend about werewolves is pretty much crap. Kurt Siodmak is the go-to guy for these things. So it's interesting how that's become kind of the known mythology now, but it was all created by one guy for one movie and went from there. Now, the interesting thing about the Wolfman is Larry Talbot doesn't turn into a wolf when the full moon comes out. He turns into the wolf when the wolf bane blooms and the moon is full. Both of those conditions have to be there, so it has to be like a springtime and a full moon. It went on later to be just the full moon because, not everywhere has wolf bane, I suppose. But the original thing was that you had to have those two things come together, and at that particular time is when a person cursed with this affliction became a wolf. So they've kind of expanded it then, because I suppose they wanted it to be a monthly curse, to just so the guys could have one too, I suppose. But yeah, so that was the interesting thing I found out from a lot of the extras on this film, is the fact that Siob Mac basically is the granddaddy of werewolf mythology. And yeah, thousands of films afterwards have used that. I mean, TV series and movies. Every time you see a werewolf, it's got to be a full moon, and they go through the whole Larry Talbot thing. Now, again, the makeup for this was done by Jack Pierce, the guy who did the makeup for Frankenstein. He worked for a very long time for Universal Studios in particular. And one of the things that I did find out, there was an interview with Rick Baker on some of the extras. He said that one of the reasons why Jack Pierce was eventually ousted was the fact that he wouldn't adapt to using the new technologies that became available for makeup work, and he kind of came behind the curve eventually. But on this one, they used yak hair and little bits of cloth and all sorts of rubber appliances. It was a very uncomfortable makeup for Lon Chaney Jr. to wear, but the results are pretty much there. The kind of lap dissolves they use to show the transformation are pretty good for the most part. There is a little bit where his legs are transforming, where you can see the pant leg move a little bit between the dissolves. But apart from that, it's an incredibly adept piece of special effects work, which the thing is that it's so easy now compared to then. The way we do it is all with computer-generated stuff. And yes, it's laborious, and it does take a lot of mouse clicks. But a lot of it's done in the computer. You don't have to think up the materials to use to have a certain effect occur. You don't have to do tests on those materials. You have to do tests on the software and that kind of thing. But the kind of physical artisanship of makeup work has varied a lot since the early days there. And it's not a perfect makeup. The original makeup was originally created for a movie called Werewolf of London, starring Henry Hull, but he didn't want to wear a full-on makeup, so they gave him a kind of lighter makeup to wear in that film, which is worth seeing too. It's got a whole bunch of interesting things in it. It's got Henry Hull, apparently was a total prick, and Warner Oland, who went along to in later days to play Charlie Chan, even though he was, I think, Swiss or Swedish. I got that mixed up in a blog once and somebody called me on it. I think he was a Swiss gentleman, and I am going to check that out right now, because the Swiss and the Swedes do get that mixed up. You know, Swedish, I apologize. He wasn't Swiss, he was Swedish. So Warner Oland was Swedish, and he was in Werewolf of London, which of course inspired a Warren Zevon song. I'm waffling a little bit on this one. Sorry, it's late in the day. It's been a long podcast, and I'm getting a little bit tired. But Maria Uspenskaya, fantastic as Maliva, the role later played by Charlie Chaplin's daughter, Geraldine Chaplin, in the 2009-2010 The Wolfman. But she's at the kind of heart of the movie. She is the Greek chorus. She's the person who comments knowingly and knowledgeably about what's occurring, and who tries to warn people, ultimately unsuccessfully, of course. But she does do so, and she is very good. That kind of foreign accent, that slightly strange intonation, the slow, measured way in which she speaks really does give this movie a heart. The rest of it's pretty much standard Universal horror movie stuff. You've got the nobility and the peasants, you've got people chasing after the monster, you've got all those other kind of tropes there. But The Wolfman was incredibly successful at the time, because people were starting to get a bit sick of Frankenstein and Dracula, and they needed to bring a third prong to that particular fork, and The Wolfman became it. Now, Lon Chaney Jr., I've read up on Lon Chaney Jr. a fair bit in preparation for this, and I've decided I don't like him as a person particularly. I think he, as I said earlier, I'm over alcoholic actors for a bit. I'm going to have to find some actors who weren't torn down by alcohol abuse and by that particular addiction, because I'm kind of getting over it. Maybe I'm getting grumpier, but I'm getting over alcoholic actors these days. Anyway, the movie is a classic. It's beautifully made. There are a few plot holes, and there are a few little continuity errors in that, as there were in all of those kind of films, and particularly films that have had the scrutiny that the Universal horror films have had, tend to be, you know, people tend to pick out the continuity errors and the errors of logic and things like that, and why, if he had a singlet on when he was turning into the werewolf, does the werewolf have a full shirt on later on, and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's an entertainment. I think that Lon Chaney Jr. is not the right person for the role, I'll be honest with you there. He does not at all act, sound, or in any way perform like the son of a nobleman. Even if he has spent a number of years in America, he's got a kind of more of a working class approach to what he does and to his persona in the film. And this is partly because the script was originally about a working class guy who comes and installs the Claude Rains character's telescope. So it wasn't actually his son. It was going to be a technician sent out from America to install a large telescope on the site so that Sir John Talbot could carry on his astronomical observations. So, yeah, that kind of doesn't work for me. But Maria Uspenskaya kicked ass. She was just the perfect thing. And she had a gravitas that grounds the movie. As indeed does Claude Rains, who was an interesting character himself. World War I veteran again. He was mostly blind in one eye because of a gas attack during the war as well. And he went on to do a number of things, including the very, very bad The Lost World. He played Challenger, Professor Challenger in The Lost World in 1959 with Lorenzo Lamas and a whole bunch of lizards with dinosaur scales stuck onto them. But anyway, Wolfman, lesser of the three films to a certain extent, though I would give Dracula part of that burden as well. But Frankenstein, of course, is the tentpole one for me. I really do think that this one brought together everything that I want out of this kind of film the best. Now I'm just going to play a little bit more of Maria Uspenskaya because I'm really big on her at the moment, and then we'll come back and get on with feedback.
The way you walked was thorny, through no fault of your own. But as the rain enters the soil, the river enters the sea, so tears run to a predestined end. Your suffering is over. Now you will find peace for eternity.
Okay, first off, we have Dr. Zom back again, and I'll just let him do what he does like nobody else can.
Paleo Cinema, this is Dr. Zom. Paleo Cinema, I must apologize this week for my lack of due diligence and not leaving some feedback. Love the show. Just caught up in that little thing called life, which once and always is a mystery, an enigma, a riddle that keeps Dr. Zom always saying, huh? Anyway, Paleo Cinema, I must apologize because I do so enjoy our collaboration, mainly because it allows me to say collaboration. What has Dr. Zom been doing besides riding the motor scooter around and around when the weather is a little bit warm enough to ride? I watched a movie the other day which I haven't seen since I was a small child, and that movie starred Jimmy Stewart. And that movie is Winchester 73. And I saw this movie a long time ago because, as a lot of kids are inclined to have been, back in our day. I'm sure they're not that way today. I loved Westerns. I loved just about anything. I would watch just about anything that was a Western. And, you know, of course, my favorites were John Wayne, Clint Eastwood. Randolph Scott jumped in there a little bit later when I discovered him. But and you know, Mitchum and just about everybody stuck their toe in the Western genre. And or as Sammy from The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema would say, genre, genre. And so anyway, I was reading a little bit about this movie, and one thing that I never really thought about until I read the one of the reviews and them talking about it was that this is actually kind of a noir. And that's kind of an interesting take on the movie, but had a good cast. And one of the people in the cast, and this kind of is going to segue into what I also have been doing, was a guy named Will Gear, who played Wyatt Earp. I'm sure a lot of the listeners have heard of Wyatt Earp. You know, he's the one that called Curly Bill and Ike Clanton, you know, told him to run, you know, you curs, and hell's coming with him, and, you know, and all that stuff. But we've seen a lot of people play Wyatt Earp. But it was strange kind of to see Wyatt Earp as just kind of a little side character in this. And the character was played by Will Gear. And a lot of you will know Will Gear from playing the grandpa on the TV show The Waltons. And Will Gear is a very interesting character. If you guys want to go back and look up his biography for all those times and you know, all those years, I didn't know that much about Will Gear. And then I found out that he actually had been blackballed in Hollywood during all that mess. Where they were trying to, you know, weed out the commies who were infiltrating cinema. And Will, you know, had attended communist functions. And I think, and I'm not really sure, I just read this not that long ago, but I think he actually was a member of the Communist Party at one time. So he got kind of blackballed there and everything, and he loved theater. The guy was a botanist. I think he had his PhD and everything, very smart individual. And one thing that about Will Gear was he was an activist for gay rights for quite a long time, because Will Gear, the grandpa in the Waltons, was actually homosexual. And you know, that was pretty interesting. And up until the day he died, he really fought for, you know, equal rights for, you know, people you know, who were homosexual. That leads me into the second thing, and then I'm going to wrap this up because I'm babbling along. My sister got me a book for Christmas, and it's called Hiding in Plain Sight, and that book is The Secret Life of Raymond Burr. And, you know, at first I was like, eh, you know, I remember watching Ironside, you know, and Perry Mason. We had the Ironside getting shot, and now he's paralyzed. He's in a wheelchair, but he's still a cop. He's a big old cop. A big old cop who gets the job done. Yes, he's Ironside. Yeah. So anyway, Ironside, it's a good book. I've liked it so far, and I encourage you know, some of you others to pick it up. It's not just one of those bullshit Hollywood Babylon books where they think they're going to just, you know, tell all about the guy's sex life and everything. That's a big part of it, because, you know, in that day and age, you know, how they tried to, the studios had to cover everything up, and does talk about a lot of his problems and, you know, dealing with weight issues. He went from anywhere from 220 pounds up to about 340, and, you know, he would drop the weight. Raymond Burr, he kind of got typecast there for quite a while, but he worked a lot in noir movies, San Quentin with Lawrence Tierney, Pitfall, the remake of M,
Love Happy with Harpo Marx, Raw Deal, where he played a pyromaniac, Key to the City with Clark Gable, Stick 'Em Up with one of my favorites, who also ventured in and made a big name in television, was Fred McMurray. He got a role in Place in the Sun, where he actually didn't have to play a heavy or a heel, and he was the attorney Frank Marlowe, who prosecuted Montgomery Clift. And also, you know, most people before Ironside and Perry Mason would know him as Lars Thornwald from Rear Window with Jimmy Stewart. And that brings me right on back to where we started. So anyway, as I make a nice linear feedback, I start at the beginning and it comes round and round back to Jimmy Stewart, Raymond Burr, Will Gear. Wrap them all up and let's call this feedback done for now, Daddy-O. Terry, Sally, Jack, and Jill. This is Dr. Zom calling from the mountainous regions of West Virginia in the United States of America. Earth, the Milky Way galaxy, saying Zom.
Thanks, Zom. I know you've not been feeling well lately, mate, so take care of yourself. Yeah, Winchester 73. I did watch it a couple of years ago, but there's so many movies between now and then that I probably have to revisit it. Yeah, it's a good Jimmy Stewart. It was around the same time as things like Naked Spur, which I've got to rewatch as well. There's a few westerns I really have to get back into. But as we all know, there are so many movies to see and way too little time to see them in. Yeah, Will Gear, definitely interesting actor. I think I mentioned his problems and his proclivities in the episode we did about Seconds, because he was in Seconds playing a vuncular but sinister character in that. Yeah, it's nice that he got that kind of end of career boost by being in all those episodes of The Waltons. I'm sure it would have helped him in his retirement, but he definitely paid his dues because of all of that stupidity with the House Un-American Activities Committee and the blacklist and things like that. And so what if somebody's a communist? As long as they're not actively making bombs and overthrowing governments, it seems absurd to me that, well, overthrowing governments is now popular, but it seems absurd to me that they ever had that kind of paranoia and nastiness happening. But of course, I would hope that we'd learn from those kind of historic mistakes. And unfortunately, they did cripple and in some cases end a number of people's lives. So thanks for that, mate. Always love your recommendations. You're welcome here anytime to throw at myself and the audience whatever the fuck you would like to. So on to the next bit of feedback. Okay, I got some feedback. It's an email from Quint, and it says, "Hi, Terry, I've been listening to the podcast for a while and thought it was time to put my finger to keyboard and give you some feedback. I first started listening after a recommendation from the GGTMC guys. That's the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, and have been hooked ever since. I love your choices of movies, and I like the way you add some trivia or little-known facts to your reviews. I got hooked on cult and genre movies watching Moviedrome on BBC Two back in the 80s. It was hosted by Alex Cox, and he would give a five-minute intro to each film at the start. I got to see The Wicker Man, The President's Analyst, Electric Light in Blue, One-Eyed Jacks, Two-Lane Blacktop, The Beguiled, and others, including some you have reviewed for the show. Great stuff, and I was sorry to see it come to an end. Some of the intros are available to watch on YouTube. I have to check that out. I just ordered the Region 1 DVD of Point Blank from Amazon on your recommendation. Can't wait to hear the commentary. I can't believe it's not even available on DVD here. It was weird hearing on a recent podcast that you and Sal visited Morecambe on your UK visit. It's only about 30 miles away from me and had a few days out there as a youngster. Thanks for doing such an amazing job and keeping me entertained at work. All the best, mate. Quint, in brackets, Paul." Thanks for that. Yeah, I like Morecambe. We went up through Morecambe Bay, had lunch at a very nice tea shop on the waterfront, and we were heading up towards Scotland because this was in 2004. Sal and I were over there, and we were visiting some of Sal's family in Liverpool. And we were sitting around on the ferry across the Mersey, in fact, freezing our asses off, and we go, "Okay, let's go to Scotland." And we go, "Okay, where do you want to go to in Scotland?" "Oh, let's go to Edinburgh first. It looks pretty." And then we got to Edinburgh and decided, "Yeah, let's go to Loch Ness." So we went to Loch Ness. But anyway, That's why we kind of cruised up through Morecambe. We went to Blackpool, which is one of the weirder places we were at, and then up to on Morecambe Bay to Morecambe. So, and there is a statue of Eric Morecambe on the waterfront, and all credit to him. I love Eric Morecambe. So, yeah, thanks for that feedback. Yeah, Point Blank, it should be available everywhere on DVD at a local pressing. It's such an important film, I think, and such an interesting one, that kind of combination of noir and violence, 60s sensibility and New Age cinema. It gives it a richness and a uniqueness that a lot of other films don't have, and, of course, it had Lee Marvin in it. What did I see him in recently? I know. Saw Raintree County. That's the other thing I saw while I was away. I saw Raintree County on TV with Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor, because Elizabeth Taylor having dropped off the twig, they were showing a bunch of her films. And Lee Marvin's in there playing a guy called Flash, with whom Montgomery Clift's character has a race. And later on, they're both on the same side during the Civil War. And that's a great little piece of acting by Lee Marvin. I recommend, if you can see a copy of Raintree County, ignore Elizabeth Taylor's histrionics. I was never impressed with her as an actress. I'm sorry the lady's died, but she was never my cup of tea particularly. I much preferred her husband's work, the one she married twice. And but anyway, yeah, see that. And when you do, just check out the acting by Lee Marvin. It's an interesting movie, too, for a number of reasons. It was kind of held up because Montgomery Clift almost died in a car accident soon after production started. And also, if you watch very carefully, you'll see DeForest Kelly's in there. So, you know, Dr. McCoy from the original Star Trek's in there as a Union officer, which makes it a little more interesting from that trivia point of view as well. But thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it, mate. Glad you're enjoying it. And thanks to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema guys for steering you in my direction. I do appreciate that. And if you're listening to this podcast and you don't download and listen to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema and any other movie cast I happen to mention, do so. I don't recommend crap. And speaking of which, not crap, but things I recommend. There's a new podcast out there done by Mondi and Mitch and Dave. They're people I know and I trust. Australian podcast that talk about movies a bit. And it's called Shooting the Poo Podcast. So if you look at that up on iTunes or just Google Shooting the Poo, I'm sure you'll find it. They've just had their first episode out there where they tore apart the Oscars. And great podcast. And if Mondi would just tell everyone wouldn't tell everyone to shut up and fuck off all the time, it would be a much better podcast. So anyway, on to the next bit of feedback. This one's from Rupert, and here he is.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. just wanted to apologize up front for hello down there. I thought you might you might dig it, but it's definitely it's a mess. It's a what-the-fuck kind of musical. And I actually did a post on my blog all about a few of my favorite what-the-fuck musicals, and that's, you know, high on my list, along with stuff like Voyage of the Rock Aliens, Strangers in Paradise, which is just bizarre, and, of course, The Apple. I just wanted to know if you're a big fan of The Apple, what you think of it. That's definitely one of the weirdest cult what the fuck musicals I've ever seen. really psyched you're covering Johnny Cool. I've had a recording of it off TCM for a year or two now, and I still haven't watched it, so I'm definitely going to watch it. For listeners in the States, it just came up on Netflix Instant Watch in the last month or so, I think. So that's kind of cool, because obviously, as you said, it's not that easy to see. But I'd totally forgotten that Elizabeth Montgomery was in it, so I'm excited to check that one out. I hope you're enjoying your vacation. I will talk to you soon, sir. Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. just wanted to apologize up front for hello down there. I thought you might you might dig it, but it's definitely it's a mess. It's a what the fuck kind of musical. And I actually did a post on my blog all about a few of my favorite what the fuck musicals, and that's, you know, high on my list, along with stuff like Voyage of the Rock Aliens, Strangers in Paradise, which is just bizarre, and of course The Apple. I just wanted to know if you're a big fan of the Apple, what you think of it. That's definitely one of the weirdest cult what-the-fuck musicals I've ever seen. really psyched you're covering Johnny Cool. I've had a recording of it off TCM for a year or two now, and I still haven't watched it, so I'm definitely going to watch it. For listeners in the States, it just came up on Netflix Instant Watch in the last month or so, I think. So that's kind of cool because, obviously, as you said, it's not that easy to see. But I'd totally forgotten that Elizabeth Montgomery was in it, so I'm excited to check that one out. I hope you're enjoying your vacation. I will talk to you soon, sir.
Hi, Rupert. Hello down there. It was worth watching, but it's weird. And, maybe I was in the wrong headspace to watch it. I've got a copy of it now, so I can watch it again at some stage. I'm sure I'll enjoy it a bit more. But, it's weird and a bit odd. Haven't seen The Apple. Going to have to track that one down and check it out at some stage. But I will do so, and I'll let you know how it goes with that. I've got a stack of things at the moment because I'm behind schedule due to going on vacation and enjoying the fuck out of myself. But thanks for your feedback, mate. I recommend your blog, Rupert Pupkin Speaks. So if you, I think it's rupertpupkinspeaks.blogspot.com, and if I'm wrong, I apologize. If not, just look it up on Google. You'll be able to find it. Definitely recommended. Rupert did a cinematic alphabet for his blog and then tagged me. So I did a cinematic science fiction movie alphabet A to Z. A is for blah, blah, blah. B is for blah, blah, blah. Last night when I should have been doing research for this podcast. But thanks for that, Rupert. Always like your support, mate. And more strength to you on the blog and the other things you do, including your guest spots on the GGTMC. Okay, let's see what other feedback we've got here. And we're going in on to an hour and a half of this podcast so far. I'm not yet in GGTMC territory where their podcast lasts roughly as long as a woman's menstrual cycle. But we're getting there. Oh, yeah, I got this one. I think it was the wrong number, but I thought, given that it came through as feedback on my number, I would play it. It's a very brief one by some guy I don't know.
Hey, this is Kyle. Give me a call and you get the message. Talk to you later. Bye.
I think that may have been one of the guys that fucked Ned Beatty in Deliverance, but I'm not entirely sure. Nonetheless, it came through on my voicemail, so I'm putting it to the air. Oh, yeah, I've got another email, too. It's all been flooding in at the moment, so that's terrific. This one's from Maurice, I'm not sure, Brzezinski. So if I pronounce your name wrong, I do apologise. Hello, Terry. I just stumbled onto your Paleo Cinema podcast, and I'm very happy for two reasons. I've just listened to episodes 71 and 69. I love Alvin Purple and thoroughly enjoyed them. Your commentary and placement of context are fascinating. I also live in Melbourne. It's great to hear a podcast about something I love, film, coming out of our hometown after hearing podcasts from other parts of the world. I was looking for an emplacement for the excellent Mondo Video podcast from London that's going into hiatus and found yours through Google. I gave it a listen and now will be a regular listener. One question for you. Have you ever seen a film from the early to mid-1970s with Bette Midler called either of these two names, The Divine, Mr. J or The Thorn? The latter title was a quick cash-in on Midler's success of the Rose, but the film was made a few years earlier. I saw it in a tiny cinema in Melbourne in the Manchester Unity building. Building's still there, the cinema isn't. It caused quite a ruckus at the time. It was seen as being sacrilegious. Released before The Life of Brian, the Monty Python team got away with it because they were funny. The film was not in the same league, although it's not without good moments. It covers the life of Jesus in a way that some folks would not have intended. I love to track it down. If you're aware of its existence or how to get it, I'd be most grateful. Hope you're enjoying your travels around the country. Cheers, Morris or Maurice, sorry. Give me a moment. I'm just going to see what I can find on that one for us. Won't be a tick while I pause and do research. 1 minute and 35 seconds later, I'm going to email you about that one, see what we can arrange. So thank you for the feedback. I always like to get new listeners, particularly local ones. I get a lot more people listening to the podcast from Europe than I do Australia, to be honest with you, and some countries in Europe more than I do in Australia. And, of course, in the US and Canada. And I'm starting to get a slight groundswell on the Arabian Peninsula. I did get someone from Abu Dhabi and somebody else from Shiraz, which is the emirate just north of Dubai. So definitely getting the word out there. And to all those people in obscure places that I don't mention, please be welcome. I'm very happy to have you listening to the podcast. So we'll move on from that. But yeah, thank you very much for the feedback, and very happy to have you as a listener. Now let's see who else we've got on the thing. Okay, let's see what I've got here. I've got a couple of voicemails. Sorry, I'm getting a bit fatigued. I'm not used to doing marathon run podcasts. This one's from Brian over at Habakkuk's, and it was taken on St. Patrick's Day. So thank you for using part of your St. Patrick's Day to have a chat with me, Brian. I appreciate it, mate. Here we go. It's in two parts because I think you got disconnected.
Well, hello there, Terry. It's Brian here from Habakkuk's. I'm sorry if I sound the worst for wear, but it's St. Patrick's Day. And I thought I'd send my cinematic well wishes to you. You know, if you're looking for a film to be watching for St. Paddy's Day, you know, I'm sure the usual one is what is it? The one with Sean Connery, the Disney one. The one with the leprechauns. Oh, it escapes me now, but the leprechauns and Darby O'Gill, yes, Darby O'Gill, you know, it was an awful, terrifying one, you know, when the curse of the voicemails has been taking its toll on me. So yes, I'll be quick. So yes, this one, the banshees and all that. So yes, Darby O'Gill. So yes, but a lesser known one is Whiskey Galore. The Scottish film, because yes, St. Paddy's Day and Scottish film, so Whiskey Galore is a good one. So when all the boat sinks and all the whiskey barrels float up on shore, so yes, happy days. So you may watch Whiskey Galore. So I shall give you a bell when I'm a bit more sober. So happy days and happy St. Patrick's Day to your good self, Terry. Ta-ra.
Haven't seen Darby O'Gill and Little People, as it was called here, since Jesus was playing Cowboys, since I was a small kid, so I know I can find a copy of it. So I'm going to have to check that out, Brian. And Whiskey Galore, I saw a number of years ago. I think it might have been an Ealing comedy. It was kind of that kind of era and that kind of genre, with tons of character actors crammed in doing great things. I'll add that to the list as well. I've got my little list here of recommendations from listeners, and I will get through them, hopefully eventually. But thanks for giving us a call. I hope the hangover wasn't too bad from that one, mate. I don't mind anybody call me up drunk, sober, stoned, comatose, or on life support. I don't give a fuck. Just call. Always happy to have a chat. I hope you had a great day for St. Patrick's Day, mate. I'm going to have to do something given my Welsh heritage for St. David's Day, but I keep forgetting when it is. I think it's earlier in the year than this. But anyway, let's see what else we have. I did get some comments from good old Paul in Canada after the music podcast. Just a brief one that was on the website. It says, great episode. Thanks for playing that stupid Lemonade song, which I love. Also, Stan Ridgway. Yes. Wonderful. So that was it for Paul, and that's it for this podcast. Next time around, I don't know what I'm doing. I've got a bit of an idea, but I'm not saying anything until I check the movie out again, and I know for sure. So it'll be two movies, and everyone will be pleased to know I'm back into the 1940s again with at least one of the films, if things play out the way I'd like them to. For this one, thank you for persevering and listening to this whole podcast. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for the love and support in the community that we get from doing this stuff. Thanks to everybody and all the other podcasts. Always appreciate it. GGTMC, the guys, and of course Mary over at B Movie Cast, the Shooting the Poo people, the writer and the critic. And there's an overlap on both of those two podcasts because Kirsten produces them both with an iron fist and a squirt gun. And everybody else that I've forgotten, because I'm not organized at the moment and my brain's fried from doing such a long podcast, and I'm going to go have a cup of coffee now and hang out with the missus and the cats. By the way, Jill the kitten is getting bigger. She was D6 successfully, and she's running around madly now, and we've got it to the stage where she can explore outside. But pretty much everything that happens outside including the impact of oxygen molecules upon her skin, scare the fuck out of her at the moment. So we're trying to getting her over that timidity. But she's doing great. Jack's doing great. Everything's fine. I've unpacked the souvenirs from the trip. I unpacked my machete, and if you've gone on Facebook and you've friended me up, you'll see a picture of me wielding my machete as a warning to house intruders. I've got it hidden very close to where we sleep, so if you're planning on breaking into this house, plan on losing a limb. Now, I don't mind washing walls and scrubbing carpets, trust me on that. But yeah, definitely having fun with life at the moment. I'm feeling very relaxed after the holidays. I'm back into the work thing. Sal and I may have some plans for the future now, which we'd like to fulfill and get going. And yeah, life is good. So if it's not good for you at the moment, you got my sympathy. I'm willing to listen if you need an ear. Really, just things get better, things pass. Shit is not a constant, shit is a transitory thing in life. So take care of yourselves, enjoy your movie watching. It's coming up on the big blockbuster season soon, and the really big special effects films are going to start coming out, and I've got a irrational passion for those sometimes if they grab my attention. So anyway, as our friend Brian would say, happy days, and take care of yourselves.